We're going to do first, the very first item on tonight's installment of RFA 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War. What I'm going to be doing is giving a brief summary and a recap of the major points that I've covered in the program so far. I'm going to touch on the major elements and try to bring those of you who might be new to the series, new to this particular archive show, up to speed. That'll be the first thing, a brief summary, because I've been going for many hours now since July 26th, so it will necessarily be a synoptic account of what has been covered so far. Following that, we're going to begin taking a look at the broader social context for what we looked at last week, namely the effects of the Reinhard-Gehlen Nazi Eastern Front Intelligence Organization on American and strategic and political thinking. Specifically, we are going to take a look at the broader social and economic and political context in which those particular events took place. Specifically, we're going to take a look at what facilitated, or perhaps in the view of some, necessitated the adoption by the United States of the grossly exaggerated reports that Gehlen gave the U.S. about Soviet intentions and capabilities, as well as the social, political, and historical context within which the so-called liberation or rollback philosophy of fighting the Cold War, originally a Third Reich psychological and political warfare tactic, which eventually evolved into a mainstream main American philosophical approach to fighting the Cold War, and ultimately became a major theme of the 1952 Republican campaign. We will, during the course of the program this evening, be taking a look at the further evolution of rollback or liberation theory of fighting the Cold War. Theology to some, no doubt, particularly some of the people we saw at the Republican convention a couple of weeks back. But we're going to begin by taking a look, once again, at Blowback by Christopher Simpson. And what we're going to look at is a fellow, the activities of and the philosophy of a fellow named Paul Nitze, N-I-T-Z-E, an individual whose activities span much of the Cold War period. And what we're going to take a look at is the economic and political environment within which the Crusade for Freedom, a CIA front organization which introduced large elements associated with this Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit, as well as their political approach, this was introduced into American society, where it became a mainstream intellectual force. What we're going to take a look at is the role, or the, what facilitated, or again, perhaps in the minds of some, necessitated the adoption, first of all, of the Victor Marchetti, a former CIA Soviet affairs specialist, called the Soviet boogeyman junk, that hyped-up Soviet boogeyman junk, which Gehlen adopted and which eventually became American political doctrine. We are also going to take a look at the context in which the activities of the CFF, which was instrumental in introducing not only Gehlen-related personnel, but also the Gehlen philosophy, the Third Reich philosophy of liberation or rollback theory of fighting the Cold War. We're going to take a look at the context in which that occurred. Specifically, both Gehlen's exaggerated view of the Soviet Union and the incorporation of rollback or liberation theory into mainstream American society served to adopt or to transform the American political opinion in such a way as massive increases in defense spending became more palatable. Both the hyped-up Soviet Russian boogeyman junk, as Marchetti talked about, referred to it, as well as the CFF's activities in introducing rollback or liberation personnel and theory into American society, and the gradual evolution of rollback or liberation theory from a Third Reich psychological and political warfare technique to a major element of American political thinking throughout the Cold War period. We're going to take a look at how these serve to justify and perpetuate in American society massive post-World War II increases in defense spending. What we're going to be doing specifically by way of taking a look at the context in which the CFF and Galen were able to operate. We're going to take a look at an article, a very important article, which we will be coming back to next week, from the current issue of Covert Action Information Bulletin. And specifically, we're going to be taking a look at a remarkable document, a central element in the evolution of Cold War America, namely NSC 68, National Security Council Memorandum, number 68. This was authored by the aforementioned Paul Nitze, an individual we will return to next week. Specifically, what American political and economic and strategic thinkers were contemplating was the effect of the end of the Marshall Plan on both the United States and Europe. And the fear was, on the part of American officials, rightly or wrongly, that the cessation of the massive aid to Europe that took place after World War II under the auspices of the Marshall Plan might lead to a renewed depression, or a certainly depressed economic activity, if not another Great Depression. And what they came up with, in a nutshell, was a program of massive military spending, which would serve to both to prime the U.S. economy and keep it going with a sort of military Keynesianism. It would also be seen as facilitating global trade. And very importantly, this military buildup would be seen as a device to break the back of the Soviet Union economically, because the Soviet Union was not seen as being able to keep up with the United States in an arms race and the resulting economic burden to society. Obviously, that is a forecast, really not so much a forecast, but a tactic, which has borne out in a big way here in the 1990s. We are going to take a look at NSC 68 and how it served to justify both the exaggerated view of the Soviet Union that the Reinhard Galen Organization gave the U.S., as well as the introduction via the Galen Organization and related elements and the CFF of rollback or liberation theory personnel and thinking into American society. Both can be evaluated in the context of NSC 68, and next week we will look on the Reagan administration in the final installment of this program as the ultimate fulfillment both of rollback or liberation theory and the doctrines inherent in NSC 68. The propaganda campaign, which was conducted by the CFF, a CIA organization, and which operated inside of the United States, that campaign was basically to justify, in the minds of the American people, the massive defense spending that was authorized under the auspices of NSC 68. And we will be taking a look at the evolution of the political and economic philosophy of NSC 68, how it worked out in the ways that its planners thought it would work out, and how it did not work out in the ways that its planners thought it would work out. And we will be returning to NSC 68, to rollback or liberation theory, and Paul Nitze once again next week. In the context of examining NSC 68, we will be touching once again on the concept of the Christian West. This was basically a Third Reich plan, a backup plan by the Third Reich to shed the more noxious elements of Nazism and to hook up with the Western nations, the Western allies, U.S., Britain, France, etc., in an anti-Soviet coalition with Germany as sort of the centerpiece. This was basically a Third Reich plan for going underground, and we're going to take a look at NSC 68 as well as briefly the Marshall Plan as a realization or a perpetuation of the Christian West concept, which ultimately led both to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization as well as to economic partnership or cooperation, at least up to a point and for a period of time, between countries like the United States and West Germany, Britain, etc. Recall that the Christian West concept was developed both by German and American intelligence agents, both of whom had figured in a prominent way, both sides of which, I should say, had figured in a prominent way in the transatlantic industrial and financial axis that I examined in numerous archive shows, the first two Radio Free America shows, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, Uncle Sam and Il Duce, and other broadcasts as well, Radio Free America number 10. What we're going to do then is we're going to take a look, touch briefly on how, although President Eisenhower, to a large extent, was elected on a rollback or liberation platform. In fact, Eisenhower and his administration, in spite of numerous pressures, including the pressures of Joe McCarthy using dirt fed by veteran Nazi intelligencers, including SS people, McCarthy attempted to smear many of Eisenhower's appointments. Despite all of the pressures and despite of the rollback or liberation inertia, the Eisenhower administration remained committed to the containment theory of fighting the Cold War, a less totalitarian, perhaps, commitment to fighting the Cold War. And if totalitarian seems like a strong concept, we're going to be examining NSC 68 as, in effect, a blueprint, a plan to ultimately turn America fascist. NSC 68 could be seen in a very accurate way as proto-fascistic. After looking at the Eisenhower administration and its adherence to containment rather than rollback theory, despite the pressures and inertia leading in another direction, we're going to take a look at the evolution of the rollback or liberation milieu, which we've been studying, and we will look at its evolution right up through 1960, and how the captive nations movement, which ultimately was the incarnation of the rollback or liberation milieu circa 1960, how it had grown into a potent force, a significant element of the far right wing of both the Republican and, to a lesser extent, Democratic parties, and how in 1960 it was able to realize its own political agenda to a considerable extent, and how it had begun to work at cross purposes with the plans of the Eisenhower administration. What we're going to do next is we're going to take a look at the assassination of John Kennedy, first of all from a strategic standpoint, and we're going to take a look at that as the ultimate triumph of rollback or liberation theory. We're going to take a look at indications that the type of political and psychological covert operation that was being conducted by organizations like the CFF had evolved during the closing years and months of the Eisenhower administration into the use of physical covert action, ultimately deadly force, in order to achieve ends that were at variance with what the Eisenhower administration sought to achieve. We're going to touch briefly, by way of discussion, on indications that the assassination of John Kennedy may have actually been contemplated or planned. The assassination of a president may have actually been planned prior to Kennedy's election. We're going to take a look at the sabotaging of the U-2 flight of Francis Gary Powers in May of 1960 that nullified President Eisenhower's attempts to achieve detente with then-Soviet Premier Khrushchev. There are substantive indications that that particular flight was actually sabotaged. It was dispatched despite Eisenhower having temporarily grounded the U-2 spy flights over the Soviet Union, and it also was ultimately blamed on Lee Harvey Oswald. That is to say, the downing of the U-2 and the deep-sixing of the summit conference was blamed on Lee Harvey Oswald, and that is an awful lot of history, as we talked about in Guns of November Part 1, an awful lot of history to be blamed on one man. We're going to take a look at other indications that possibly there were plans afoot prior to John Kennedy's election to assassinate the president if the president did not pursue an agenda sufficiently vigorous for the appetites of the rollback or liberation milieu. We will review briefly how Lee Harvey Oswald defected to the Soviet Union on October 15th, 1959. This was the same date on which Stefan Bandera, a Ukrainian fascist who worked first for the Third Reich and then for U.S. intelligence and ultimately for the Galen Organization when it became the West German Intelligence Service, the assassination of Bandera happened on the same day that Oswald defected to the Soviet Union and was ultimately linked by far-right and fascist elements, specifically those grouped around the WACCFL, the World Anti-Communist Congress for Freedom and Liberation, the steering group for what became the World Anti-Communist League. The assassination of Bandera, allegedly performed by the KGB, was linked to Lee Harvey Oswald and his alleged shooting of John Kennedy, and this was one of the stratagems which led to the supposition on the part of some that if the truth came out about the assassination of John Kennedy, ultimately it could lead to a third world war if the public perception was such that international communism, quote-unquote, had assassinated John Kennedy. We're going to be taking a look at the painting of Oswald Red and the role that played again this evening. Many people, it is the view of many, that one of the motivating forces for members of the Warren Commission and its associated group of attorneys, one of their motivations for covering the assassination up, or the motivation of some of them anyway, was to prevent a Third World War, and it was the fear of many that, in fact, that might have happened if Oswald was perceived to be a Soviet or a Cuban agent, and there were abundant attempts by elements like the WACCFL to make Oswald appear as just such an agent. We took a look at that in the second installment of this particular program. We're also going to take a look at a fascinating detail presented in a book called Forgive My Grief, Volume 4 by Penn Jones, that in 1959, the next to last year of Eisenhower's administration, in 1959, three Americans defected to the Soviet Union, including Lee Harvey Oswald. All three repatriated to the United States in 1962, and we're going to take a look at Mrs. Ford, that's Katya Ford, Mrs. Declan Ford, one of the white Russians in the petroleum Galen-associated milieu, intelligence milieu, that we looked at in our first two installments of this program. Katya Ford, Mrs. Declan Ford, who we will be coming back to the Fords, Declan and Mrs. Ford this evening. Robert Edward Webster was one of the Americans who defected in 59 and repatriated in 62. When questioned about why Lee Harvey Oswald defected to the Soviet Union, Katya Ford asked Marina said that Lee went to the Soviet Union for the RAND Corporation to set up an American exhibit at the World Trade Exposition. This was the cover story used by Robert Edward Webster, one of the other Americans who defected in 59 and repatriated in 62. That is, to say the least, a remarkable coincidence, and it is the view of a number of people. It is suggested by Penn Jones that this indicates that, in fact, Marina was confusing the stories of the patsies, and that, in fact, plans may have actually been afoot prior to John Kennedy's election to assassinate the president if, in fact, the president elected in 1960 did not pursue a sufficiently vigorous agenda for the rollback or liberation milieu. Following that, we're going to take a look at, by way of review, not only what John Kennedy did by way of deviating from rollback or liberation theory, but John Kennedy's substantive attempts to, at the very least, de-escalate, if not end, the Cold War. We're going to take a look at how Kennedy ran afoul of the national security establishment vis-a-vis Cuba, vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, vis-a-vis Southeast Asian and Latin American policy as well. One of the new details, a new detail that we will be adding this evening, new to me anyway, is the fact that one of the things that John Kennedy did that outraged the national security establishment and the far right, the rollback or liberation milieu, which we've been looking at for some time, one of the things that he did was he refused to recognize three right-wing military governments in Latin America. In 1963, there were coups, military coups in Guatemala, the Dominican Republic, and Honduras. John Kennedy refused to recognize any of these juntas. That outraged the national security establishment. Those coups were almost certainly aided and abetted to a certain extent by U.S. intelligence. After that, we're going to return to the coup of 11-22-63, the assassination of John Kennedy, in which the petroleum Galen intelligence milieu, which we looked at in our first two installments, and bear in mind that George Bush is part and parcel of this milieu, and we will be touching back on Bush and some of his connections this evening. We're going to take a look at this rollback or liberation milieu, this Galen-related and petroleum and intelligence-related milieu, how it operated and the context, the political and economic context in which it operated. What we're going to do is we're going to begin by taking a look at how some of these Galen-associated white Russian elements were functioning in connection with the assassination of John Kennedy. First of all, we're going to take a look at how Marina Oswald's testimony in the first couple of days after the assassination was mistranslated in such a way by an individual named Peter Gregory, and this mistranslation coincided with the translations of Marina done by Ilya Mamontov. We've looked at both of these petroleum-related White Russians in the first two installments, and we're going to take a look at how Marina's testimony was distorted in such a way as to make it appear within the larger context that, in fact, Lee Harvey Oswald was a Soviet agent, and as we've seen, the fear on the part of people in the part of some of the people that were investigating the assassination, particularly liberals who knew what had happened, the fear was that if that myth got perpetuated or was believed by the American people, this could lead to a Third World War. We're going to take a look at how Peter Gregory distorted Marina's testimony in such a way, and he actually mistranslated what Marina said, and how this played into the hands of those who were deliberately trying to make it appear as though Lee Harvey Oswald was a Soviet agent and the assassination the result of a communist conspiracy. What we're going to do is we're going to take a look after that at how this rollback or liberation milieu, this Galen-related White Russian petroleum-related milieu that we looked at in our first two installments, functioned at the microcosmic level, one could say, at the operational level, in conjunction with elements of Army intelligence and Army Reserve intelligence. We're going to take a look at the presence of both Army intelligence agents and Army Intelligence Reserve agents, both on the Dallas Police Force in the Secret Service. We're going to take a look at the presence of some of these individuals in Dealey Plaza, how they functioned. We're going to touch back on a fellow named Jack Alston Creighton, an employee of DeGolyer and McNaughton, a petroleum engineering firm, which we looked at in the first installment, and that's a name that you should bear in mind because he was also in Army Reserve intelligence. We're going to take a look at the curious behavior of the pilot car that was in President Kennedy's motorcade. That pilot car contained Dallas Deputy Police Chief Lumpkin, an Army Intelligence Reserve agent, also the local commander, Lieutenant Colonel Whitmire, of Army Reserve. We're going to take a look at its curious behavior on 11-22-63. We're going to take a look how this pilot car, traveling 3 minutes in front of the motorcade as a whole, stopped right in front of the Texas School Book Depository, how an individual supposedly had an epileptic seizure. This is accurately portrayed, by the way, in the Oliver Stone film JFK. That epileptic seizure led to the clearing by the Dallas police of a path to Parkland Hospital, yet the individual never had an epileptic seizure. It was a white male who then walked away and was never treated at the hospital. That path that was cleared conveniently, perhaps coincidentally, perhaps conspiratorially, cleared the path for Kennedy's car to go directly to Parkland Hospital. Also, we're going to take a look at how an Army intelligence agent named James Powell was in Dealey Plaza right at the site of this particular epileptic seizure. James Powell then became sealed in the Texas School Book Depository, ultimately that on the orders, the Texas School Book Depository was sealed on the orders of Deputy Chief Lumpkin of Army Reserve Intelligence. James Powell, this Army intelligence agent, was sealed inside of the Texas School Book Depository, and then Dallas Police Lieutenant Revel ordered a search of the Texas School Book Depository, which miraculously turned up the Mannlicher Carcano rifle, which Oswald supposedly used to shoot Kennedy. We're going to take a look at how information was passed to the U.S. STRICOM, as it's called. That was a Joint Army and Air Force command group to generate a quick, powerful strike force. It was located in Florida, would have been very prominently located for a U.S. attack on Cuba. And interestingly enough, a member of the Dallas Police Intelligence Unit named Stringfellow provided information, disinformation, as it turns out, to the U.S. STRICOM on 11-22-63 that Oswald was part of an international conspiracy, that he had defected to Cuba and was a member of the Communist Party. And interestingly enough, the Army Intelligence Group, which provided that to U.S. STRICOM, was the Fourth Army's 112th Intelligence Group, of which James Powell just happened to be a member. Revel's boss was a fellow named W.P. Ganaway, head of the SSB, the intelligence section of the Dallas Police Department. He also was an Army Reserve intelligence agent, and he worked directly with a Secret Service officer named Winston Lawson to plan out President Kennedy's motorcade route, the security arrangements for it. Winston Lawson of the Secret Service was also an Army and Reserve intelligence agent, and Winston Lawson, according to numerous reports coming out of the Dallas police records, and contrary to his own testimony, ordered that two motorcycles, which were supposed to escort President Kennedy on either side of his limousine, were ordered to the back to follow behind him, thereby making Kennedy far more vulnerable to a crossfire. We're also going to take a look at a Detective Adamczyk, a Dallas policeman who was a member of the Army Reserve, and his role in coming across a rifle blanket in the garage of the Paines, which also helped to frame Lee Harvey Oswald. We're going to take a look, too, at how the Dallas police recruited, or the Secret Service and Dallas police recruited additional help for President Kennedy's trip to Dallas, and we're going to take a look at how the attack on Adlai Stevenson, not a mortal attack, a few weeks previous, served as justification for the recruiting of additional help by the Dallas police and the Secret Service. It appears that Army intelligence agents may very well have been recruited to help out with this particular, with the security arrangements for Kennedy's Dallas trip. And there are certainly substantive indications that this Army intelligence, Army Reserve intelligence milieu, branching the Dallas Police and the Secret Service, appears to have been a central element at the operational level in the assassination of John Kennedy. It should be recalled that Deputy Chief Lumpkin, or we will note that Deputy Chief Lumpkin, who recruited Ilya Mamontov to serve as Marina Oswald's translator on 11-22-63, was recruited by Jack Alston Crichton, former employee of DeGolyer and McNaughton. Jack Alston Crichton, also an Army Reserve intelligence agent. What we're going to be doing for the duration of the broadcast is we are going to begin, I guess you could say, dollying back. We're going to widen the camera viewpoint, and we will begin by taking a look at the operation level. Again, how this White Russian petroleum Galen-related milieu functioned at the operation level first, in conjunction with elements of Army intelligence and Army Reserve intelligence at the street level with the Dallas Police and Secret Service. And then we're going to begin dollying back. We're going to get a wider camera angle, so to speak, and we will begin looking at the functioning of this Galen-related petroleum industry White Russian milieu. And we're going to see how it begins to function in conjunction with larger and more significant political and economic elements. What we're going to look at next is the operation of this very same milieu in the context of something called a corporation, a major land operation called the Great Southwest Corporation, a joint Rockefeller and Wynn family operation. The Wynn family were very powerful industrialists and financiers in the Dallas area. And that they were also allied with the Murchisons, an even more powerful family. And we're going to take a look at this joint Wynn, spelled W-Y-N-N-E, by the way, joint Wynn-Rockefeller operation, the Great Southwest Corporation, and how this same Galen Petroleum-related milieu, this rollback or liberation milieu, functioned in connection with that. A fellow named James Martin, an employee of the Great Southwest Corporation, became Marina Oswald's manager. It was he who sold the bogus picture, the altered picture supposedly showing Lee Harvey Oswald with the rifle with which he supposedly shot John Kennedy, to Life magazine. He also recruited a veteran Cold Warrior related to the CIA named Isaac Don Levine to write Marina's story, and Isaac Don Levine predictably tried to link the assassination of JFK to a Soviet conspiracy. James Martin also recruited Ilya Mamontov, the same Ilya Mamontov who served as the translator on 11-22-63 to work for a subsequent translation, subsequent translation of Marina's life story. Now, Marina was put in touch with the Great Southwest Corporation by the aforementioned Peter Gregory, again, part and parcel and an element of this Galen Petroleum Intelligence Rollback or Liberation Theory milieu. After James Martin was fired as Marina's manager, his role was taken over by an attorney named William McKenzie. William McKenzie was an attorney with the law firm of Wynn, Jaffe, and Tinsley, which handled all of the legal work for the Great Southwest Corporation. William McKenzie illegally coached Marina Oswald to provide details incriminating her husband. And William McKenzie is a very interesting fellow. He resigned from Wynn, Jaffe, and Tinsley, again, the law firm that handled the legal work for Great Southwest Corporation, two of whose employees, by the way, helped to corroborate, two of whose other employees helped to corroborate disinformation generated by Peter Gregory in the earlier translation of Marina. We're going to take a look at William McKenzie and how he, in order to become Marina's manager, resigned from Wynn, Jaffe, and Tinsley and went to work as a law partner with a fellow named Pete White. Now, Pete White had been an assistant district attorney with William McKenzie. He had helped clear Jack Ruby on an earlier gun charge in 1954.